Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month our selection is an offbeat private eye story by former newspaper reporter Peter Hochstein, whose name may not be well known to our readers yet because most of his previous fiction, including a number of paperback original novels, was published under various pseudonyms. Lately, the author has turned his attention primarily to the short story. The series to which this story belongs began in the anthology Dark City Lights, edited by Lawrence Block. The following is the second story in the series, and we have a third coming up in our September-October 2017 issue. Here is Peter Hochstein reading his wry tale, The Client, the Cat, the Wife, and the Autopsy.
Man coming to see you, I heard Christina say when I picked up the telephone. Tall, blonde, and willowy, Christina's the only treat for the eyes you'll find at Success Deluxe Workplaces. That's the decaying dump of a cubicle farm where I rent the tiny space I call my office. Is the conference room free? I asked her. You reserved room, so for you it is free, said Christina. Her Polish accent was as thick as the fog over the harbor at Gdansk, which happens to be where she hails from. But only for 1 hour, she said. After that, somebody else has meeting. Okay, I said. No problem. I couldn't imagine a first meeting with a new client that would last for more than an hour. I grabbed a notebook and a pen and walked to the reception area. A small, balding man in a drab black suit was pacing back and forth near Christina's desk. Take him to conference room quick, Christina said in a hushed voice. He won't sit still. He won't stand still. He is making me crazy. She rolled her blue eyes and pretended to wipe her brow with the back of her hand. If my new client happened to notice any of this, he didn't show it, or maybe he was just too agitated to notice. Mr. Glazenberg, I presume, I said, holding out my hand. He reached out to shake hands, but then suddenly yanked his hand back, as if he had suddenly decided he needed permission. You're Rich Hovanek, the private investigator? He asked cautiously. Please don't call me a private investigator. I prefer to say I'm a former newspaper reporter who does research on sensitive topics. But yeah, I'm Rich Hovanek. I started to withdraw my own hand, but then, evidently assured that I was actually me, he reached out again to shake. This created an awkward but mercifully brief ballet of hands extending and retracting before we finally managed our handshake. His palm was moist, and his grip was half-hearted. Mr. Hovanek, I've got a real problem. You see, I interrupted him. Why don't you come into the conference room where we can talk privately? He nodded and looked relieved, as if he had fully expected that I'd force him to talk in front of Christina about whatever troublesome matter he brought to me. I led my new client to the conference room, motioned to him to sit down, then sat across from him. I opened my notebook. Okay, just for the record, your first name, Mr. Glazenberg, is... Marvin, he said. He nodded, as if to reassure himself that he had his own name right. People call me Marv. And for my record, your address? He lived up in Carnegie Hill in the East 90s. Nice neighborhood. That was good. It made it more likely that he'd have the money to pay me. I'm not outrageously expensive for someone in my line of work, but you'd be surprised how many people agree to my $150 hourly fee, ask me to stake out their cheating spouses all day long for a few days, and then have a meltdown when I hand them a bill for around $5,000. Best to get a retainer if you can in advance. I copied down Marv Glazenberg's telephone number, email address, bank and credit card information, and his work address. He was chief financial officer for a smallish company that manufactures brassieres. You know, that's interesting, I said. There's a woman down the hall who puts out an online newspaper called Stocking and Lingerie News. It's for the ladies' underwear trade. Maybe you'd like to meet her after we're finished here? Meet her? He asked. For what? He was holding his necktie in both hands and wringing it as if it were a wet rag. He didn't seem to be aware he was doing it. Well, maybe she could give your company some free publicity, I suggested. Oh, no, I... He took a long pause. That's not my department. Not exactly a go-getter, this Marv Glazenberg. On the other hand, didn't somebody once say, nothing focuses a man's mind like the prospect of his own execution? Maybe he was in big trouble of some kind. Maybe he couldn't think past his problem, whatever it was. Okay, Marv, why don't you tell me why you're here, I said. It's terrible, he began. My wife may leave me. She's barely speaking to me. And we have this terrible, terrible problem because Caramel dropped dead on my living room floor. It was all of a sudden, mitten grinning. Terrible, just terrible. Hold on, I said. You're going too fast for me. And you're using words in what language is that? Yiddish? For starters, what does mitten grinning mean? It means in the middle of everything. In the middle of everything, he fell down, collapsed, died, keeled over, dropped dead. Actually, he ran around in circles. Then he jumped up toward the living room curtains. And then he dropped dead in midair, mitten grinning. Who is he? Our house guest. You were letting some house guest run around and jump around in your living room? And in the middle of all that, he drops dead? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay, take it easy, Marv. Calm down. And what was the name of this house guest? I just told you. Caramel. Caramel what? Just Caramel. We were taking care of him, and then this happened. Taking care of him for whom? Our friends, the Rosenbaums. They went sailing in the Caribbean, and they left their cat with us, and the cat dropped dead for no reason. And what are we going to do when the Rosenbaums come home and ask for their cat? And on top of everything, my wife is in a rage. She's ready to divorce me because I had a little slip of the tongue, and I said something I didn't mean to say when I learned that the cat dropped dead. She's been moody lately anyway. Wait, slow down, Marv. This Caramel, your house guest, she's a cat? Marvin Glazenberg began speaking very rapidly. Yes, a cat, a caramel-colored cat. Very expensive. They brought it from a breeder, whatever breed it was, and it was only 6 years old. That's young for a cat. We thought we were doing the Rosenbaums a favor, and now look, they might sue us, and Eleanor is acting crazy. Who's Eleanor, I asked. Another cat? Eleanor is my wife. Listen, Marv, I said, here's what I'd like you to do. I'm having trouble figuring out why you've come to see me after a cat that you were caring for died. So I'd like you to start at the very beginning and tell me very slowly and very calmly what happened and why you're here. Do you think you can do that? Slowly? He thought so. Okay, he began. This is how it happened. We have these friends, a couple called the Rosenbaums, Susie and Steve. They're big sailors. They have a boat and they keep it in a yacht club on Long Island, Port Washington, Long Island. They're retired and financially comfortable. Well, actually, they're loaded. And every winter, they also go sailing for a month in the Caribbean. Not in their own boat. That's in dry dock for the winter. They rent the boat somewhere in the Caribbean. But the thing is, Susie Rosenbaum has this cat. Had this cat. Caramel? I asked. Yes. And they try to leave the cat with people they like and trust instead of boarding it. This year, it was us. So we agreed to it. So they brought the cat and its two dishes and its sandbox and a carton of fancy feast to our house. Caramel likes the elegant Medellin Tuscany flavor and the tender turkey flavor, although I think there were a couple of other varieties the Rosenbaums left for us as well. They also left something called Blue Buffalo Wilderness Salmon Recipe. You'd be amazed how many different flavors and brands of cat food there are. I'm sure I would be, I said. Listen, Marv, do you think you could get to the point? Oh, sure. Sorry. Anyway, taking care of the cat was pretty easy. You open a can of food for it twice a day. You put out water. You clean out the sandbox with a little rake and a plastic shovel once a day. We kept the sandbox in our powder room. And that's it. And he was doing just fine for the first few days. Maybe he spent a lot of time sleeping, but he seemed happy. Caramel? Yes, Caramel. Then last night, my wife Eleanor went to the refrigerator and noticed we were practically out of milk. And she asked me if I'd run out to the deli on Madison and 92nd Street for a quart of milk so he wouldn't have to drink black coffee in the morning. She hates black coffee, and the deli stays open real late. So what's this have to do with the cat, I asked Marv. Well, I put on my coat and my hat, and it was very cold last night, you may remember, so I got a scarf from the top of the closet and my... Marv, please skip all that. What about the cat? Well, I took the elevator down to the lobby. I went over to Madison and 92nd and bought a quart of milk. And by the time I got back to the front door of my building, Sal the doorman is standing there with a house phone receiver in his hand. And he hands me the receiver and he says that my wife is on the house phone and that she's saying the cat is dead. And I thought, what? That couldn't possibly be. I saw Caramel alive and looking perfectly happy 10 minutes ago. I grabbed the phone. I asked my wife what was going on. She was screaming. She was sobbing. She sounded hysterical. The cat is dead. The cat is dead, she said to me. He's dead in the middle of the living room floor. Dead. So I run back to the elevator and I take it up to the apartment. And there's my wife looking all upset and holding her hands to her face and crying. And right in the middle of the living room floor is the cat, Caramel. And Caramel's not moving. So, okay, I admit I panicked. I mean, the Rosenbaums are our friends. I feel responsible for that animal. And there it is, dead on my living room floor. What am I going to tell the Rosenbaums? They'll think the dead cat is our fault. And that's when I yelled at my wife. I didn't mean to yell at her. It just came out. What came out? I asked Marv. What the hell did you do to the damn cat? That's what I yelled. And she screamed back, I didn't do anything to the cat, you accusatory bastard. Why is everything my fault? That's why I'm starting to hate your guts. And then she said to me, it just ran around in crazy circles a couple of times. And then it jumped into the air toward the living room curtains. And when it hit the carpet, it was dead, just where you see it. And that's not my fault. I scribbled a few notes, reading them half aloud as I wrote. Cat runs in circles, jumps for curtains. Falls down dead. Husband and wife yell. Then what, I asked. Well, I looked at the cat. It wasn't moving, but its eyes were wide open. And I put my hand on it. It felt warm, like a living animal, not a dead cat. Of course, if it had just died a few minutes before, it would be warm. But maybe it was warm for another reason. I got into my head that maybe Caramel wasn't really dead. Maybe he was just in a coma. Maybe he was even watching me through his open eyes, paralyzed, but hoping I could help him. Maybe if I could get him to a vet soon enough, Caramel could be revived. So I wrapped the cat in a towel and ran downstairs with him and jumped into a cab and went to that big veterinary training hospital. You mean the Animal Medical Center on York and 92nd Street, I asked. No, he said. The other big one, over on the west side, the University Hospital for Small Animal Research. Anyway, the cab gets me there. I'm frantic. I throw $2 $20 bills at the cabbie. That's way too big a tip. The fare plus 20% would have come to a total of only about $22. I gave him 40, but I didn't want to wait for change. And I ran out with the cat wrapped up in the towel. And I ran up a little flight of stairs they have, yelling, "This is an emergency! I need a vet! I need a vet now! Emergency!" And just as I got to the top step, a very cute-looking vet comes out of the office. I could tell she was a vet because she had on a white coat and a stethoscope. And she looks at me like I'm a nutcase. And then she looks at Caramel wrapped up in a bath towel. And then she looks at me again and she says, very slowly and very calmly, "What's your rush? That cat is dead." And I blurted out, "She can't be dead. She's not my cat." I'm afraid my voice was very loud. And then the vet looks at me suspiciously. And she asked me whose cat it is, was, if it wasn't mine. So then I had to explain to her about the Rosenbaums going sailing and leaving the cat with us and how I was coming back with milk when my wife called down and said Caramel was dead. And I told the vet that I didn't know what I'm going to say to the Rosenbaums when they come back from the Caribbean. I need some kind of explanation. I don't want them thinking my wife or I killed their cat. And what did the vet say? I asked Marv. She didn't say anything. But I told her I wanted an autopsy on the cat. I figured if a big university hospital gives a written explanation, an autopsy, the Rosenbaums would know their dead cat wasn't our fault. And do you know what the vet said to me? I had to admit I didn't have the faintest idea. She said, sorry, we don't do autopsies on DOAs. DOA means dead on arrival. Yeah, I know what DOA means, I said to Marv. Then I told her if she wouldn't give Caramel an autopsy, I didn't know what to do. When the Rosenbaums arrive at my front door asking for their cat, I just can't tell them the cat is dead and too bad. I need to explain what happened. That's why I need an autopsy. I'll pay whatever it costs. I mean, whatever it costs within reason, so that the Rosenbaums will know it's not my fault. So did the vet do the autopsy? I asked Marv. No, she didn't, he said. The vet said that no DOA autopsies was a firm policy. But finally she told me, well, maybe we can figure this out without an autopsy. How did the cat die? Did he exhibit any bizarre behavior? So I told her, I don't know from cats. What's bizarre behavior for a cat? All I know was the cat was alive when I walked out of the apartment, and by the time I got back, the cat was dead. And my wife said the cat was running around in circles and jumped into the air, and then plots, boom, dead. And the vet says, running around and jumping in the air is very bizarre behavior. She says, what probably happened was the cat threw an embolism. You know, a blood clot, threw an embolism either to the heart or the head and felt a sudden sharp pain, and that caused Caramel to panic. So he ran around in circles for a while, maybe even jumped because he was scared, and then bang, the cat was dead. She told me I'd be relieved to know that the cat didn't suffer very long. And I said, great. I need a note explaining that on the hospital's letterhead. I need to show it to the Rosenbaums when they get back from the Caribbean. So she gave you a note that got you off the hook, I asked. She gave me a note, all right. If it was about the death of a human being instead of a cat, it would have sent me straight to the execution chamber. Here, read it for yourself. He pushed a piece of paper across the desk to me. It was handwritten on the hospital stationery. It said, to whom it may concern, Mr. Glazenberg arrived in the emergency room of the University Hospital for Animal Medicine and Research today at 9:47 p.m., presenting a dead cat. According to Mr. Glazenberg, the cat exhibited, in quotes, bizarre behavior, and then died. If what Mr. Glazenberg says is true, this would be consistent with the diagnosis of an embolism, either to the heart or to the head. Very truly yours, Marilyn P. Sallisto, DVM. You see what I mean, Marv said to me? The note reads like she didn't believe me. I didn't even know cats could have bizarre behavior until she told me about it, and she's putting words in my mouth. And then the next thing that happened, what next thing? She asked me what I wanted to do with the cat's remains. Did I want to take them home and save them for the Rosenbaums? She said I could put the cat in a plastic bag and put it in the freezer and it would last for quite a while, or the hospital would cremate the cat for me. It was my choice. Well, I didn't know what to do. The Rosenbaums were sailing somewhere in the Caribbean. They're at sea. There's no way I could reach them by phone or email. And even if I did, what could I say to them? Come home right away because your cat is dead? All I'd do is ruin their vacation. Besides, what about our housekeeper who comes every Wednesday? What if she opens the freezer and finds a dead cat? I agreed with Marv. That might take some explaining. Yes, it certainly would need explaining, Marv Glazenberg said. But on the other hand, imagine the scene if the Rosenbaums came to the door and I handed them a plastic bag with their cat's frozen corpse in it. I even thought of waiting until they come to the apartment for their cat and then looking them straight in the eye and saying, what cat? I don't remember any cat. Of course, I wouldn't really do that. But the point is, I didn't know what to do. Then it occurred to me, maybe some little bit of good could come out of this tragedy if only the cat's life wasn't a total waste. Maybe that would bring some solace to the Rosenbaums. I asked the vet if the cat's body could be donated to science. You know, to help veterinarians learn something that would keep other cats alive, or something. Or maybe it's the same way with cats as it is with people. You know, you donate their organs that help somebody live after you die. Maybe Caramel's lungs and corneas can help make another cat's life better. Anyway, the vet said that yes, the hospital could take the remains for study. And I'm hoping... Hoping what, I asked Marv. I'm hoping that now the hospital has Caramel's body for science, they'll do a thorough examination, maybe even an autopsy, because Caramel isn't any old DOA anymore. He's a gift to science. And if you can get me that autopsy report, Mr. Hovedek, and if I can get the autopsy report to the Rosenbaums instead of that horrible note that sounds like I'm saying stuff that the vet doesn't believe, maybe the Rosenbaums will stay friends with us and won't sue us. Okay, Marv, so what you want from me is documented evidence of the cause of Caramel's death. Is that it? Yes, that would go a long way toward helping us keep our friendship with the Rosenbaums, and might even help quiet my wife, too. Eleanor has been very short-tempered with me lately. I mean, sometimes she acts like she hates me. I don't know why, but maybe if this whole story has a happy ending... He left the thought dangling there. I asked him for $1,000 retainer, and he willingly wrote out a check. As soon as he was gone, I picked up the phone and tried to call Dr. Callisto, the veterinarian who had written Marv Glazenberg's excuse note. It took a while to reach her. I tried three times, leaving a polite message on her voicemail each time. No response. Not that I minded her dodging me. Hey, I bill by the hour, and the more time I have to spend trying to talk to somebody, the more money I make. But after a while, I figured enough was enough. So I decided to use one of the old newspaper reporter tricks of mine. It was the kind of stunt I pulled years ago when I was up against a deadline and needed to get somebody on the phone fast for information or a statement. So I called the Animal Hospital switchboard, and I told the operator I was calling from Dr. Sallisto's gynecologist's office. I said I had her blood test results and that I urgently needed to speak to her. Could she possibly be paged? That did the trick. 3 minutes later, she was on the phone. I apologized for pulling her away from her work, but I had a serious situation on my hands. Well, hurry up, she said. I've got a schnauzer wide open on the operating table, and it's almost time for my lunch break. So I got right down to it and asked her about the cat, Marv. Yes, she remembered Marv, she said, and yes, he had donated the cat's cadaver, and as a matter of fact, they were planning to dissect it in a feline anatomy class that she would be teaching that afternoon. Sorry, no transplants for other ailing cats, just a dissection to show young veterinary students where the heart and lungs and muscles and other internal organs go. I'll call you again tomorrow after you've done the dissection, I told her. Please return my call this time. I have a man who is suicidal and that I'm trying to help. That lie worked too. She called me back at 3 p.m. the following afternoon. Hold on to your chair, Dr. Sallisto said. Uh-oh, I said. What's the problem? Well, as we began working on the cat, we noticed a great deal of occult hemorrhaging. There was blood around some of the gums. There was blood behind the corneas. When we got him open, we saw there had been bleeding in the internal organs. There was a lot of blood inside the skull. Do you want more of the bloody details? I whistled. You mean just jumping in the air and falling down could cause all that? No, I don't, said Dr. Sallisto. But warfarin could. Warfarin? I think I've heard of it, I said. It's an anticoagulant, the vet said, a blood thinner. The right-sized dose in a medicine called Coumadin helps people with narrowing of the arteries and can help prevent strokes. But some pest control suppliers take bigger doses and wrap it in some enticing rat bait. It's purposely not strong enough to kill the rats all at once, because once a rat eats from the bait and dies right away, the other rats won't go near the bait. Rats aren't stupid. So the dosage is just enough to kill a rat slowly over time, so that the rat and his friends don't know what's making them feel bad. Meanwhile, the rat keeps sharing the bait with its friends. After a while, the rat starts feeling sick. But the food is delicious, and it's in a place that's easy to reach, so the rats keep coming back. There have been cases where there are trails of blood leading from the nest all the way to the rat bait. Even when they're half dead, they listlessly drag themselves from the rat hole to the bait to eat more. That's the way exterminators wipe out whole rat colonies. How does the cat figure into this, I said. We sent the blood sample down to our serology lab for testing, and sure enough, it came back positive for warfarin. But there wasn't just a little warfarin. It was a massive dose. My guess is somebody deliberately force-fed that cat warfarin, a huge dose of it, all at once. I sat silently for a moment to let all that sink in. There was no point asking for a written report from the doctor now. A copy of the report from the serology lab would certainly prove what the cat died from, but it would be so damning, Marv would never give it to the Rosenbaums. I thought you told my client the cat threw an embolism, I said to the vet. Wouldn't the warfarin dissolve that embolism or keep it from happening in the first place? There was no embolism, the vet said. What your client described was typical of how a cat with an embolism might behave. But if you want my opinion, the cat never behaved bizarrely. It just lay down, feeling sick, and bled to death internally. Okay, I finally said. Thanks. This is very interesting. It's more than interesting, she said. It's an animal cruelty case. Poison 1,000 rats and you're doing a public service. Poison 1 cat and you're a criminal. It's a misdemeanor. Under some circumstances in some states, it's a felony. I think your client might be facing some jail time. No, I don't think he did it, I said to her. He's been too worried. He's terrified about what the owners of the cat will think when they come back from the Caribbean and learn their cat is dead. He wouldn't kill that cat. I think there's somebody else involved. Who? The vet asked. I really should report a cat poisoning. I told the vet what I do for a living and that I might be able to secure more evidence. I begged her to hold off for a few days. She grudgingly agreed. I hung up and called Marv at his office. Marv, I need to talk with you in person, I said. I met him after work hours in a bar called the Pleiades up on East 76th Street. It's not terribly far from where he lives. The place is carpeted and relatively quiet for a bar. We found a table in the quietest far corner. "How are you feeling, Marv?" I asked him. "Funny you should ask," he said. "Not so hot. I don't know what it is, but I've been feeling kind of tired." "Are your gums bleeding?" "Gee, it shows," Marv asked. "Not really. I'm just asking. By the way, and there's really no genteel way of asking this, have your bowel movements been bloody recently?" "How did you know that?" Marv asked. "It's a symptom." "A symptom of what?" he said. "Marv," I said, "I think your wife is trying to poison you." "No, that's impossible," he said. "What's this all about? I thought you had information about what happened to Caramel." "It's all kind of tied together," I told Marv. And then I explained my theory. First of all, his wife had been acting in a way he called moody. And they certainly weren't getting along very well. And then I explained the business of the cat's death from warfarin poisoning. And now Marv was exhibiting some of the symptoms of warfarin poisoning that rats exhibit. He was listless. He was bleeding. "Marv," I said, "if I were you, I would get out of the house before you end up dead on the living room floor, too. If you want my best guess, your wife tested out the rat poison on the cat to see if it would work, and now she's feeding it to you. Does she cook you dinner most evenings?" "This is nuts," he said. "I'm not going to sit here and listen to this." He reminded me of the kid who presses his hands to his ears and yells, "La, la, 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 I can't hear you." "Marv, I'm telling you to run to your doctor and get your blood tested for warfarin. In fact, forget the doctor. Get yourself to the nearest hospital emergency room. Mount Sinai Hospital isn't far away. Let's go there now." "Nonsense," he said. "The vet told me the cat threw an embolism. That's a blood clot. If Caramel had been given warfarin, his blood wouldn't have clotted. And now, for some reason, the vet's changing her story? Look, Caramel had all the symptoms of an embolism, like Eleanor described. It couldn't have been poison." Poor guy. He was in total denial. I said, "Marv, did it occur to you that maybe your wife is lying? Maybe she heard about a cat that went crazy and died from an embolism, and then she just attached the same symptoms to Caramel. Or maybe she researched the subject. I don't really know." "No, you sure as hell don't, Mr. Hovanek. Send me an invoice for your services. We're done." He was wringing his necktie again. There wasn't much I can do. You can't call the cops and say you know a guy who had a cat that died and that you spoke to a veterinarian on the guy's behalf, and the veterinarian said the cat was poisoned, so clearly the wife must be trying to kill off her husband. I learned during my days as a reporter covering crime stories that cops are very here-and-now types. Show them a dead body or a bank robbery or an embezzlement, and they'll light up like Times Square having a power surge. Tell them you have a theory about a crime that hasn't happened, and all you have is some iffy evidence that might, just might, indicate it may happen. Well, do all that, you can put an entire detective squad room to sleep. So I just waited and made sure to pick up the New York Times when it hit the street every night and to read the death notices before anything else. Sure enough, Marv Glazenberg's name popped up in the paid death notices 6 days later. And I'd like you to know that I heartily disapprove of my own reaction, which was to look up at the ceiling and say under my breath, "I told you so, Marv, you poor sucker." Then I called one of my own contacts up on the 19th precinct, Bill Morrissey. He was a young, plainclothes cop back in the days when I was a newspaper reporter. Today he's a detective first grade. "I've got a hot tip for you," I told him. "Sorry, Rich, I don't play the horses anymore," Morrissey said. "Very funny. I'm talking about a murder on your turf yesterday." "There were no murders reported yesterday," he said. "Not in this precinct." "Exactly," I said. "So if I were you, I'd grab somebody from the New York Medical Examiner's office real quick and get to a corpse I'm going to tell you about. Get there before it gets buried. And don't say I didn't do you a favor. Oh, and one more thing. Bill, what have you got in mind?" Morrissey asked. "I generally refuse to buy the newspaper I used to work for," I said, "ever since they fired me for punching my jerk editor in the face. But I have to admit, they've still got the best crime coverage in New York. So when you bust the victim's wife, please let me know. I want to go down to the newsstand, and for once, I intend to buy their stinking rag."
The Client, the Cat, the Wife, and the Autopsy is copyrighted by Peter Hochstein. Music for this podcast is by Benjamin Ann and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.